What is your name? The song we just sang talks about names. It talks about our worthless name. We all have names, various different names and titles that we wear. Our friends and family give us nicknames. We earn names or titles. It's part of our jobs and our education. Title of doctor, the lawyer, master builder. There are names that we carry that we share. Our family name, our various different team names or fandoms, all of those different titles that are part of who we are. That name embodies various different aspects about us, and as people know our name, our reputation goes right along with that. Name's usually one of the first things that people find out about us when we first meet. That was true of Moses there at the foot of Mount Sinai when he met God in the form of a burning bush. As part of the conversation in Exodus chapter 3, verses 13 and 14, Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent you.'" That's literally what the word Yahweh means. He who is. And it's kind of interesting, that name is itself an argument. Because if Yahweh is the God who is, that draws a circle around Yahweh. And inside that circle is the God who is. And every other God stands in contrast to that. They are the gods who are not. And when you take a name like that, you kind of have something to live up to, something to prove. And what happened when Moses went to Egypt, a land with many gods? He systematically disassembled, showed his power over every domain that those gods supposedly carried, and showed that he was indeed the God who is, and had power over all those things. Some names have an argument, a similar argument to that, and I think of one example. It's an organization called the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Now, when you have a name like that, that suggests that you are for the ethical treatment of animals, right? And we can all agree with that. As Christians, we believe in stewardship over all of God's creation, right? So treating animals ethically, that's something we can get behind, right? But if you, what would you think if I told you that, well, this organization had on many occasions done rather atrocious things to the animals in their care? Could you get behind them then? What if I told you that they elevate animal life sometimes above that of human life? Is that a Christian principle that you could agree with? Could you support an organization like that, where they took a name that said one thing, but that name was a lie? There are lots of organizations that take names that seem innocuous, that make an argument, that are ultimately opposed to things that you would be opposed to. And, well, if you oppose PETA, then surely you would oppose the ethical treatment of animals, right? Not necessarily. The name isn't necessarily, it's only valuable if it's true. And if a name ultimately isn't true, if it stands for things you can't stand for, then you could oppose the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and still believe in treating animals well. So God has a name that's an argument that's true. Other people take names that are ultimately lies. A good name, a true name, a respected name is a precious thing. In Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1, it says, "A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. Favor is better than silver or gold." What value do we place on our name, on our various names and roles? Which of those names takes priority in our life? We wear a lot of names. When someone asks, "Who are you? What is your name?" they're really trying to get at, to start to understand, who are you? Today, we are going to look at three young men whose names, their good names, were taken away from them. Their names are Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. You're all familiar with their story, I believe. You know who they are. These were princes of Israel, children of the nobility, educated, aristocratic, And when Israel was conquered, they were taken off as slaves. Slavery's meant many different things in many different places. In their instance, they were to spend 3 years to be trained and indoctrinated in the customs and science and mythology of their new land. They were to eat food from the king's table, sumptuous meals likely filled with spiced meats and elaborate things, a constant subtle reminder of exactly who owned them and whose whim their life depended on. Hananiah's name meant Jehovah has been gracious. When that name was stripped away from him by the chief of the eunuchs, he was replaced with a name that means the command of Aku, the name Shadrach. Mishael, whose name means who is equal to God, was given the name Meshach, which means who is like Aku. Who's this Aku? Well, it's one of the Babylonian gods. In case you haven't figured out who the third name is, Azariah, whose name means Jehovah has helped, his name was changed to slave of the god Nebo, or Abednego. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I expect some of our Jewish friends might be appalled that we think of them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because were these the names they would have chosen for themselves, names that honor foreign gods? Is this the identity that they wanted to have, or would they much rather continue honoring the names that they had from birth, names that honored the God Most High, names that honored Jehovah and Yahweh? Well, here they are, slaves in this foreign kingdom, given this new role, one that they can't really fight, that they can obey or die. Well, what did they do? What name, what identity here did they honor? Well, they went along with their new role as much as they could. And then they decided there are lines that we will not cross. There are places where those names come into conflict. Where they agree, we will continue. We will honor both names as much as we can. But where they disagree, where they conflict, we will draw a line here and no further. At first, this was something they incorporated into their daily lives. That food that was offered to them, well, they couldn't know if that food had pork or various different unclean meats and fish. They couldn't know if that, they might well know that meat, that food was indeed offered to idols. So when they were taken to their meal times, they said, no, we'll take the kosher meal, please. They chose, rather than eating suspect food, to eat only vegetables and water. That's a whole lot of salad. They had to negotiate for this. They said, give us 10 days. I guarantee we will prosper. If we don't, do with this as you will. After 10 days, they were found to be healthier and better shape than all the other captives from that particular batch. So they were allowed to continue. After 3 years of indoctrination, when they were presented to King Nebuchadnezzar, he had this to say, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters who were in all his kingdom. You see, they honored the role that they were given as much as they could. They set themselves to the tasks they were given. They went with them, I would suspect, to the glory of God. And God blessed them for it. Now, they'd incorporated God, their God, identity as children of Israel, into their daily lives. What happens when there comes a conflict? Because it's easy when you're sitting down with all of the other servants. You can eat your meal, and people next to you might notice that you're doing something a little bit different. But when your king erects a giant golden statue in the middle of the province that you're overseeing, and commands that every time the band plays, everyone who can hear it bows down before that statue. Well, now you aren't sitting down at a meal with everyone. Now everyone else is on their knees, bowing before this strange idol. And you're standing straight. Because one of the lines they would not cross was they bowed in worship to no God but Jehovah. Now King Nebuchadnezzar, who viewed himself as the embodiment on earth of the god Bel-Marduk, he took this personally. When he heard of this, it describes his reaction. This is chapter 3, verse 13. Said he was in a furious rage, commanded that they be brought before him. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was nothing if not a merciful king. If they agreed to bow before this idol, he would forget the whole thing. But if not, verse 15, they would be immediately cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? You think burning and fiery is describing a furnace? You only need one of those. It's kind of redundant. But you put them together, it kind of intensifies the whole thing. This was a blazing inferno he was threatening him with. An inferno fit for a king's wrath, an emperor's anger. Love their answer. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, chapter 3 of Daniel, beginning verse 16, answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. I think what he's getting at is our actions stand on their own. Our words are unnecessary. We stand, we don't kneel before this God, before this idol. He continues, if this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us. Deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. They trusted God. They didn't trust God to save them. He admitted as much. God may save us. If it be that he saves us from your hand, he has the power to do so. They trusted God. Not necessarily to save them, but he trusted God to be with them. See, if they were tossed in that fiery furnace and God saved them, then they could live to serve God another day. And if God let them die, they got to go home and be with him, and so much the better. They had faith in God. As we know, they were tossed into a fire so hot that the guards who threw them in, bound hand and foot, clothes and all, those guards did not survive the experience. The heat was that intense. And when Nebuchadnezzar looked into that fiery furnace, expecting to see three bodies being turned to ash, he saw instead four figures standing there, walking around in the middle of this blazing inferno. And one of them, as he described it, had an appearance like a son of the gods. I don't know if this was the son of God. I tend to think it was. But there was, God was with them. God saved them. They didn't expect that, but they knew it he could if he wanted to. So they were spared from the fiery furnace. When they came into conflict, which identity did they choose? They chose the one that honored God. No fire man can put us through compares to what God has in store for us. No fire is worth that. So what is this, the application of this story for us? The world today seems rather obsessed with various identities. We have gender identity, racial identity, political affiliation, your various teams and fandoms. These things seem to consume people to one degree or another. I think this is a symptom of something bigger. We live in a society that by and large has rejected God. They want God contained inside of church buildings where these strange Christian people go on a Sunday, and then they leave it there when they step back out into the world. That's what the world would want. That's what Satan wants. And so we have a world where they don't have anything like Christ in their lives, and they're looking for something big enough to replace him. I'll tell you a secret, it doesn't exist. In that effort, you will fail. The third commandment's kind of interesting. It says, thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain. And that word take has the same kind of meaning that we give it today. It's the same word as it means to carry or to lift up. And there's another sense that we use that word when a woman gets married. Traditionally, she takes the name of her spouse. She takes her husband's name. She carries that name. From then on, everywhere she goes. As Christians, when we enter into that watery grave of baptism, We take a new name. Sometimes I wonder, do we carry that name in vain? I'm not positive that that's what the third commandment is getting at, but there's certainly a Christian principle that we are to wear Christ's name, to honor Christ's name in everything we do. Just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego honored it in their daily life, at their meal times, this is a good place to start for us. Do we pray at our meals? When we're in public, do we pray over our meals? Do people see that we are Christians? Or do we kind of hide that when we go out of these doors? Do we make a habit of incorporating that identity into our daily life? In prayer, in Bible study? Do those around us see our identity as Christians in how we talk, what we talk about? Do they see it in our integrity? Will we put up with lying or disobeying, breaking the law, and all of these things that might go on around us in some kind, in some professions, around some people? People who cheat and steal, who embezzle. Do we put up with that kind of thing? Do we do it ourselves? Can people tell that we wear the name of Christian? Or do we wear it in vain? Is that name empty in some parts of our life? That's our daily walk. That's eating the vegetables, as it were. If you don't make a habit of doing those kinds of things, if Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael hadn't made sure to incorporate God in their daily activities, how hard do you think it would have been when there came a direct conflict, something where they had to either go along with the crowd or make a stand? Do you think they would have been ready to do that? Do you think they would have been strong enough to do that if they hadn't had a steady diet of being a faithful servant of God? I don't think so. Where will these conflicts come in our life? They can come from all sorts of different places. Probably the most important identity that we have after, I hope, Christian, is our family. What did Jesus have to say about how family should be prioritized relative to our walk with Christ? Well, in Luke 14, verse 26, he had this to say: "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Does Jesus here literally mean that you hate your family? I don't believe so. But when compared to how committed we are to be to Christ, when you take that and compare it to how much we love our family, which should be a lot, it should look like hate when set side by side. I think that's kind of the hyperbole, the exaggeration that Jesus is getting at. He puts it more plainly in Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. It says, "Whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Even our role as family must come second to our role as Christian. And we have responsibilities as Christians to our family. But if our family member asks us to do something that is against our Christianity, that stands in opposition to our love of our God, if they expect us to permit or enable bad behavior, are we to go along with that? Or are we to remind them, no, I'm a Christian. I can't do that. Many other things I would do for you, but I will not violate, I will not change who I am as a Christian for you. That could be hard. It could be a challenging thing. So if this can come from our family, it can also come from those in authority over us. Our employer could ask us to do something unethical. Our government could demand things of us that we can't give. In a lot of Muslim-controlled countries, it is against the law for a Muslim to convert to Christ. Places where Sharia law is the law of the land, some of those, it can even lead to death. It's a capital crime to convert from Islam to Christianity. It can be punished with, harsh sentences for Christians to even proselytize to these people. Is that a condition we could live with? Or do we risk violating the commands of man to be a Christian, to spread the gospel through our example and our teaching? Things weren't much better for Christians in communist countries, the USSR, Maoist China. Being a Christian was a very risky thing. You could risk exile and all sorts of other nasty punishments. Do we bow to governments that tell us to violate our faith? Mark chapter 12, verse 17, Jesus had an answer to that. He said, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's." We have responsibilities as a Christian. In California right now, congregations are forbidden from gathering in some counties. And throughout the state, it's forbidden for them to sing praises to God. Now, if a congregation chooses to do those things, that's fine. But is it okay for us to stop worshiping God as we've been commanded just because a government tells us to? Is that a reason to disobey God? Ananias, Azariah, and Mishael didn't think so. I don't believe so. That's not what the Bible tells us. Our priority is our role as Christian, whatever a government tells us to do. Galatians chapter 1, verse 10, it says, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I trying to please man? If I were trying to please man, I would not be a servant of God." There are people out there in the world, and some of them in places of power, even here in America, who would love to see the doors of churches close and never open again. Where do we draw the line on that? We don't usually have to ask those kinds of questions, but times like these, you suddenly realize that we aren't really that far away from something like that. It's amazing how fast those kinds of things happen. One person said of bankruptcy, it happens slowly at first and then all at once. Well, that's what happens to our Christian liberty if we aren't careful, if we don't protect it. And then we're made faced with even harder choices. Proud of our elders and how they've handled this. When it seemed prudent, when things were uncertain, looked bad, we stopped. We continued things online. When we had more information and it felt reasonable to do so, they chose to open. And never in any of that did I get the sense that these decisions were made out of fear of man or of this, you know, microscopic organism. And that's another place where these kinds of decisions can come. In a time of crisis and time of plague, of hardship, we have choices to make. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 13, we have David's response. He's given a choice. He committed murder as only a king can. And so God offered him a punishment as only you could punish a king, a punishment on his people. He was given a choice. Among those choices was an invasion by a foreign army or a plague. You know what David chose? He said, "Let me fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is very great. But let not me fall into the hand of man." He chose the plague over an invasion. Which would he rather have? To be at the mercy of men or the mercy of God? Fear of this disease shouldn't stop us from being Christians. Stop us from treating one another like Christians. And we wear these masks. We do the social distancing, all these things. These things won't save us. If these were a cure, would save us from this thing, then places like Hong Kong or the Philippines that have been more compliant than anywhere else in the world wouldn't be seeing, you know, in the case of Hong Kong, a third shutdown. In the case of the Philippines, something like a 600% growth in the number of cases in the last few weeks. And they've been doing all of these things. We could take measures, but we can't stop what we would traditionally call an act of God. And should something like this stop us from doing our duty as Christians, from worshiping God, from honoring him in everything we do? Statistically, you could pick a month, any one specific month next year. Your odds of catching this thing and dying from it are the same as dying in a car wreck that specific month. See, new risks always seem worse than the ones we deal with every time we get into an automobile. That's not your risk of dying in a car wreck, by the way, in your lifetime. No, that's much higher. It's your risk of dying that one month. Fear is more contagious than any disease. We cannot live in fear of God or man. Well, fear of God, yes. Fear of man, fear of beast, fear of microscopic pseudo-organism. No. We should fear and honor God first, foremost, and only. Here's my prescription with all of this. I believe however we choose to cope with these things, we need to do it in a way that honors God. It needs to come from a place of prayer and study, not fear. And we need to honor one another and respect each other's decisions. We should never look at one another merely as vectors for contagion. And I see a lot of people, when they see another person, they look at them in fear. We are Christians. That is the identity that matters. And when you go out into that world, each and every other living soul bears the image of God. And we need to treat them as such. Just because we're afraid of this thing can't stop us from preaching God's word to the lost. That's what matters. All this talk of the spread of asymptomatic COVID, I'll tell you something that doesn't spread asymptomatically, and that's Christianity. We must not have an asymptomatic faith, because no one's going to catch that. Now, this is a pulpit, not a soapbox. But let me leave you with one more thing. Many years after the events there in the plains at that giant statue in the land of Babylon, there was another man who also had his name changed. Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar, a name that was a prayer asking the protection of Bel-Marduk on the king. I don't think it worked. Daniel survived several kings of Babylon and was still considered indispensable in the rulership of the city of Babylon, even after the Medes and the Persians took over management. And when they brought in their own people, still Daniel was right there at the head of the leadership, one of the three men over all of the management of the land. And when they looked for something, some way they could take him off of that high seat, you know what they said? Daniel 6, verse 5, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against him unless we find it in connection to the law of God." How many of you have enemies where that's the only thing they could say against you? The only way they could conspire against you was with God. If I can find a way that the law conflicts with their Christianity, I know what will win. Daniel's faith wasn't asymptomatic. They tricked the king of the Medes, Darius, into passing a law forbidding bowing in worship to anyone but anyone else for 30 days, punishable by an overnight stay in the best lion's den in all of Babylon. And as is the custom of the Medes and the Persians, once the king writes down a decree, it cannot be changed. There's some backstory that might come up later in Esther. He spent a day and a night trying to find a loophole, but man, they crafted a decree so specific, explicit, and unassailable that he couldn't wriggle a way out of it. And when he went to that lion's den to throw Daniel in, the king declared to him, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." Daniel 6, verse 16. And I think I know Daniel's faith. Daniel, who throughout the book of Daniel, he never seemed to call himself Belteshazzar. He always wore the name he was given. And so when it came between the judgment of man and the judgment of God, he honored his name, Daniel, which means God is my judge. But you know what? God stayed the mouth of those lions, and he was saved. And if God hadn't stayed the mouth of those lions, you know what Daniel would have said? Good. I get to be with him in heaven. And as God is my judge, I have been good to him. I have followed him. Is your faith, is your Christianity asymptomatic? Or can your enemies say, like Daniel, the only thing we could find against him is as it pertains to his faith in God, to to his religion? Is your Christian identity above all of the others in your life? Yes? No? Do you wear the name of Christ? When you go out into the world, do you wear it at all? Would you like to? If you have need of the prayers of the congregation, or want to take on the name of Christ, entering into that watery grave, reenacting the death, burial, and resurrection, emerging again as a new creature, the invitation is yours as we stand and as we sing.